Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Natasha Williams in for Ann today. Last week, we got our first look at the electoral politics of abortion after the Dobbs decision that overturned Roe versus Wade. Kansas voters rejected removing abortion protections from the state's constitution in a decisive 59-41 vote. Abortion rights prevailed in the red state that Donald Trump carried by double digits less than 2 years ago. Now, activists on both sides are wondering what will happen if such a vote were held here in Ohio, what it means for the midterms. Our weekly roundtable joining us this week, Daryl Rowland, senior reporter for the Columbus Dispatch.
Great to be here.
Good to have you here. Jeremy Pelzer, he is a politics reporter for Cleveland.com.
Hi, great to be here.
Hello. And Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Joe, glad you are here.
It's always a good time.
So what does everyone think about the Kansas abortion vote? I mean, obviously, a big deal.
Yeah, it is a big deal. And, you know, it was put on the ballot. They're in a different situation than Ohio. Let's specify that, because they had protection for abortion rights in their constitution when Roe versus Wade was overruled. In Ohio, we don't have that. So we're in a different starting point. So let's make that clear up front. So what they were voting for was a bunch of the anti-abortion forces had gone out. They wanted to make it so that that abortion protection went away in Kansas. And they put an issue on the August ballot to let people decide, do we keep that in the Constitution or not? The no vote was actually the vote that determined it and kept it in the Constitution. It was surprising because they had record numbers of people coming out and registering to vote.
Long lines.
They had a turnout that they clearly did not expect. It was huge. And, you know, it tells us a couple of things. I think one thing it tells us is that this issue is energizing on both sides. We often only hear about the anti-abortion side of it. But if you also listen, there are a lot of people who are on that other side who want abortion rights. And often they are not heard, especially at the Ohio State House, where it's a majority Republican, supermajority, actually. And the legislature, the bills that they consider are to restrict or eliminate abortion rights versus the other way around. So oftentimes the people who are on the other side of that are appearing at a committee hearing somewhere along the way, but there's not a lot of movement there.
Well, Joe, there are groups in Ohio that are working to get that constitutional amendment protecting abortion rights on the ballot. That's not going to happen this November.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, they just simply don't have the time. I mean, you're talking about probably getting a 500,000 signatures to get to the number of valid signatures, which I think is around 440,000 valid signatures is what they need. And so you'd want to gather way more than that. And then you've got so many days to put it on the ballot. So they cannot possibly, it's already passed, deadlines are already passed for that for this year. They could do it next year. There's a lot of strategy that goes into when to put it on the ballot. Do you want it to go on the ballot in an off year? Do you want it to go on the ballot in 2 years from now? I mean, it's going to be, there are a lot of choices that people have to make, and I'm just going to predict this. If one side gets something on the ballot, I think we're going to see what we saw with the smoking ban back in 2006. I think we're going to see the other side get something else on the ballot, and it will be a confusing thing, just like it was back in 2006 when we saw the smoking ban that we now have was on the ballot, but the restaurant beverage folks put a different thing on the ballot, and it became very confusing. So I think if one side puts something on the ballot, we're going to see the other side answer with something. So when and if we do have something on the ballot, I think it will be multiple. That's just my guess based on past experience.
Jeremy, jump in here now. Do you think that the vote will affect how Ohio Republicans approach the issue of abortion heading into the midterms?
I think that especially since Republicans are in control of just about every facet of state government, that this is not going to fundamentally change what they do. They are looking at a near total abortion ban already. We have effectively a six-week abortion ban in Ohio. And opponents of the Dobbs decision and supporters of abortion rights, The question is, not only, as Joe said, when do you do it? The question is, what does this look like? Mm-hmm. You know, do you guarantee full abortion rights? Do you allow bans, like Kansas bans abortion at 22 weeks? Mm-hmm. Do you allow that? And there's going to be internal debate within the Democratic and liberal and abortion rights communities about what that should look like and how you proceed on that. And as Joe says, you know, 2023 is more likely probably to get passed because it's going to be you're not going to have all the noise and bustle of a presidential election. But on the other hand, 2024, you can get it's going to be more expensive to run a campaign. But then you can also help people like Sherrod Brown get reelected.
A mixed bag. I mean, Daryl, what do you think? Do you think it's going to be something in between, as they said, with a lot of stuff thrown in to try to get people, I guess, motivated?
Well, it will be curious to see. I mean, because Kansas sort of had the perfect opportunity. Obviously, this vote was set up before the Dobbs decision. This already was scheduled to be on that ballot. So it wasn't like Supreme Court decided Kansas put it on the ballot. This was already happening. Now, obviously, the stakes increased tremendously after that late June decision from Washington, from the majority of the Supreme Court justices. So in some ways, it was perfect timing that the interest is at its peak. And that's the question. Will this issue have staying power? I mean, I think sitting here, most of us would say yes, because it's, I mean, it's been a hot button issue in America for 50 years now. It's hard to see how it's going to go away. We are talking about, when we talk about 2023, just to be clear, it has to be the general election of 2023.
Right.
Any citizen-led move to get this on the ballot, which is how it would have to happen, would be barred from the primary, and the legislature could put something on there. So we're talking general election of 2023 at the earliest. So we're talking, what's the political environment going to be 1 year plus? Again, it seems clear now, but a lot of us have not done real well at predicting future political environments, Natasha, for some reason. And like Jeremy said, it's from a political standpoint, what do the folks that want to restore abortion rights in Ohio, what do they go for? Because if they go for, you know, if they have a wide open proposal and critics can say that favors abortion right up to birth, I don't know if that will fly in Ohio. I don't know. That will be labeled as extreme and what have you. I was talking to Allison Russo, the House Democratic leader, who's, I don't know if she's right at the center of this, but she's part of the discussion about where do you draw the line? Because your hardcore abortion rights folks don't necessarily want any limits, but we have political realities in a state like Ohio. You could ask for too much and wind up right where you are now or even worse.
If I could add something real quick, I think there's definitely, though, a sense among abortion rights activists and Democrats and liberals that you got it. It's like gun control. You got to do something. And whether that means going through the state legislature, and even if the bill doesn't pass, introduce the bill, put your flag in the sand and do something. And I feel that there's a lot of anger out there among those folks, and they just want something to be done to express that anger.
And probably I should have added that one way the playing field is perhaps very likely to change is the so-called heartbeat bill is no longer going to be the law of Ohio. The legislature is moving toward a total, you know, personhood bill, granting at the moment of conception personhood to whatever you folks think that is. One side says, you know, fetus or zygote or whatever. Other side says unborn child. And, of course, that fuels the whole debate here. Mm-hmm. When you have that dividing line right at the beginning, it's awful hard to come to compromises from that point on, which is why this issue has been a hot button for 50 years and more. So if that passes and we have personhood at conception, which, depending on how it's written, could also even make illegal certain forms of birth control, in vitro fertilization, things like that.
They're already floating that kind of stuff out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if that then becomes the law of the land, say, next year, when they're going to vote on that, then that makes, we talk about the pro-choice side, if you will, to one extreme. Now that would be the pro-life side, if you will, at the other extreme.
Well, Joe, you spoke with Ohio Right to Life President Mike Gunadakis about what happened in Kansas. What did he have to say? He's been pretty vocal.
He has been. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He said that he thinks the timing was part of it. He didn't know why they'd put it on the August ballot, although it was Republicans out in Kansas who did that. And, you know, I think, you know, from the accounts that we read, it must have been somewhat of a surprise, you know, to
they
have
thought
all
there'd
these...
be lower turnout.
Yes,
they thought.
Yes. Because mm-hmm. Theoretically, I think most people believe that Republicans are more likely to turn out for primaries, Democrats go for the general. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of the rule. At least among political pundits. And you can see in numbers that that's usually the case. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that sticks out to me is as this goes on and as we have the six-week ban, effective six-week ban, or if we go into the state passes a ban that's even more strict, people are seeing how that's impacting situations. We're reading about the 10-year-old who was raped, who went to another state to get an abortion. We're hearing stories of women who have very difficult pregnancies and are having to make very difficult decisions and almost dying because they can't get care.
Because physicians are afraid to actually carry out
right.
Women that are actually carrying dead fetuses for, or in their bodies for until
Well, that's the thing with an exception. The doctors are saying the exceptions that are written in, we do have an exception in the current law, probably would have an exception, I would think, in anything that's written forward to protect the life of the mother. Mm-hmm. The thing is that you can give that to six doctors and they're all going to have, and six attorneys, and they're all going to have
different perspectives
mm-hmm. of where those lines are. And when doctors are not sure if they can do something, they don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the deal.
And especially when the stakes are so high in that decision
yeah.
under the current law, if you are, you know, somebody files charges against you, your license is on the line.
Right.
And fifth degree felony, which almost is lesser. I mean, you know, you could serve a few months in jail and be done with that. But
lose
your medical license, your license, that's your livelihood. That's your career. Mm-hmm. You know, all those years gone to medical school and practicing and probably lots of student loans and everything. And you're looking for a new job.
Well, the Indiana doctor was under scrutiny and
right.
is still under scrutiny because in Indiana, still available services. She performed it and all kinds of threats and things have happened
right.
to her.
Yeah, just look what happened to her. And, you know, so doctors are very concerned about this. And as this goes on, we're going to see more of these stories come out. And I don't know what effect that will have, but it seems like a lot of people are talking about them. So... You know, I does that have an effect on public opinion? We will have to see.
Well, Jeremy, what about the impact on the Senate race from between J.D. Vance and Tim Ryan?
It's kind of too early to tell because right now not many people, not many voters comparatively are paying attention to the Senate race unless you're kind of folks like us who are political junkies. And I'm sure a lot of listeners out there, too. But you bet your bottom dollar that it's going to be an issue in October when people are paying attention, and especially for Tim Ryan. And then again, you know, as if you're a longtime listener of All Sides, you know that Tim Ryan was not always pro-abortion rights, and I'm sure that will come up as well.
So, Daryl, you talk about Ohio lawmakers paying attention. Jeremy just mentioned that. Are they paying attention to the Kansas situation? They have to be, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and these folks are all politicians. They see the backlash here among those who don't like abortion rights being taken away. And I think that's where the strength of the emotion is now. I think what the folks who are happy about the Supreme Court decision about banning abortion rights for the most part, I think they're not... for the most part, are not out there gloating or celebrating
no.
openly about it because they don't want to. It's like, they realize it's, yeah, I like that, but I'm not going to shout it out on the street corner how happy I am because of this volatile political climate. As Jeremy and Joe, we all well know, Republicans are hugely favored to maintain their large majorities in this state, pretty much regardless of anything. But still... politicians are, you know, best at self-preservation. That's number one on the list.
As always.
Yes.
Well, abortion is an issue that's seeping in the races, and at first glance, you don't have anything to do with abortion. Taylor Sappington, the Democratic nominee for state auditor, said voters sometimes question his focus on abortion and the ruling overturning Roe versus Wade. Sappington said the issue matters because Ohio's auditor sits on the state capitol, a state's political map-making commission, which draws districts for entities that do have a role. Do all of these, or do all of you think that abortion will have an impact on those races as well? We kind of got into it a little bit. Do you think?
I think the people who are very vociferous, very focused on one side, I think, yeah, that's going to matter for them. That we're going to see people who are going to vote straight Democrat, straight Republican tickets based on this one issue, probably. How much this issue will affect their vote is another thing, because, you know, we are dealing with inflation, and people are upset about that. We've got people who are upset on a number of other issues. And I think, you know, the thing that we're seeing right now is a lot of people are kind of looking at all of these issues in total, and they're just upset. I mean, if you talk to people, they have a lot of things going on that make them mad, or, you know, things that they want to correct. So I guess the thing is, will abortion be a sole driver? We haven't seen that in the past. I don't know that we'll see that in November.
Motivator, though, at least, right?
Well, in some cases, Democrats probably welcome this. If the more that's emphasized, yeah, the less, you know, yeah, the worse inflation in 40 years is emphasized. And, you know, the less we have to talk about, well, do you agree with all Joe Biden's policies that, you know, he's a tremendously low popularity ratings, you know. No, let's talk about abortion, even though it almost seems counterintuitive because it is such a volatile issue. Mm-hmm. But the lines are kind of more well-defined on that. And Joe's right. I mean, sometimes the post-election polls are a little misleading on what motivates people. But abortion, at least is in those exit polls, are seldom cited as this was top of the list. And the polling I have seen, it's more the abortion rights side where it's a one-issue voter than those opposed to abortion.
Right.
And especially for some of these down-ticket races. Like if you polled 100 Ohioans about what the Ohio State Auditor does, I bet you north of 90 will I be like, they audit stuff.
Jeremy, you're cracking Ohio voters today.
Well, you know, it's easy to dunk on a Monday. So if you are one of these candidates then and you want to gin up a lot of enthusiasm for your race, and especially if you're a Democrat, you're going to want to tap into this. You know, Keith Faber, who's the Republican incumbent auditor, has also touted his endorsement by Ohio Right to Life. So it's not just Democrats.
Right.
And it's a way to kind of win voters over to your side and generate enthusiasm when voters might not necessarily be enthusiastic about what the job you're running for entails.
And there is a treasurer, forgive me, I forget which state, that is running very vociferously. She happens to be against abortion rights, but she's making that a centerpiece of her campaign. And on one hand, you know, and we as reporters, it's, you know, you interview, when do you ask the abortion question? City council races, school board races, whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these folks do, who are the future legislators. Very often they're drawn from these lower office ranks. I mean, at least from a journalistic standpoint, it'd be nice to put even those lower offices on the record about some of the biggest issues in the land. So we know now, and not till 6 years from now, when you're running for the state Senate, it's like, oh, gee, that person is pro or anti this.
So are we expecting an article from you on that?
I'll get my people on that. Busted. All right. Sorry.
Well, you are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with Jeremy Pelzer, a politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Daryl Rowland, a senior reporter with the Columbus Dispatch. We'll be back in just a little bit to talk about the primary last Tuesday, the expected low turnout, when we come back. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Natasha Williams in for Ann today. It's our weekly reporter roundtable still with us. Daryl Rowland, senior reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Jeremy, Ohio held its unprecedented second primary last Tuesday, and an expected turnout was very low. Can you remind us why we had two primaries, the very controversial situation?
Well, I'm happy to talk about this. It gives me another opportunity to diss Ohio voters. turnout was about 8% statewide. And the reason was is because all the marquee races were already voted on back in May. And the reason that legislative races, which is what people voted for last week, and state central committee races for political parties, it's because there was a redistricting fight for months and months and months that just
wouldn't push back
legislative district creation to the point that they could not be held during the May election. And so finally, you know, just out of necessity, the legislature budgeted $20 million and local governments threw in even a few million too to hold this primary that virtually no one voted in. There was a quote in Cleveland.com from the Cuyahoga County Board of Elections director who said that it was almost like they didn't feel it was an election.
Yeah. I actually saw that. So what are the impacts of such a low turnout? I mean, other than it seems like a lot of money that's just kind of almost wasted.
Well, the impact, first of all, is if you are running a race, it leads to a lot of volatile, you don't know who's going to win going in. You know, if you only have a few thousand people voting, and you could be, we'll see who ends up, you know, winning in November, but you could win a race even if you get your friends and family and neighbors to show up. And some people actually lost, like three incumbents lost their seats. Bride Rose Sweeney beat Monique Smith up in Cleveland. You had Sean Stevens losing his primary in Delaware County. You had Mark Frazier over in Newark lose his seat to Thad Claggett. And even Betty Montgomery, who was running for a state central committee spot or for re-election on the Republican State Central Committee, she lost to a bar and restaurant owner.
And that can't be understated, actually, because it can't be overstated, because Betty Montgomery has been involved in Republican politics in this state
forever.
For as long as I've been covering. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can remember her. You know, she's always had a hand in helping the party with, you know, getting people elected. And she and Joanne Davidson have been backbones for women in the Republican Party who want to run for office and that sort of thing. And so to have her not win that seat was pretty big.
I mean, very well-known name. I mean,
right. And that's, you know, again, you just have such a handful of turnout. So I'm a little hesitant to make, you know, sweeping conclusions. But again, that's what happens when you have a crazy mixed up turnout and primary as we did. But yeah, Betty Montgomery, the first woman attorney general in Ohio history.
Yeah.
And again, not to take this too far, but that may say a lot about the movement that we've seen in the Republican Party of the last, certainly the last decade, some might say a couple of decades, where people like a Betty Montgomery or a Joanne Davidson, both of whom, by the way, are for abortion rights, are far, far from the mainstream of the Republican Party these days. And some of those past statewide office holders, Jim Petro, Paul Pfeiffer, no one thought they were liberals at the time, but now they certainly would be amongst their Republican peers. Even John Kasich, I guess. You know, he talked about this more than anyone, some of it a little self-serving perhaps, but he says, I didn't move, the party moved. And, you know, he's not all wrong.
And to support what Daryl's saying, Montgomery lost to a bar and restaurant owner who was fined and actually moved her restaurant from Granville after being fined for violating COVID mask policy, and moved down to Buckeye Lake and ran, and both she and her husband won state committee seats.
Mm-hmm. I think she sells ice cream now, too. Right?
Oh, it's open.
Yeah.
Spreading out, branching out.
Well, Daryl, Republican candidates for the Ohio Supreme Court raised double what their Democratic challengers were able to raise in June and July. According to new campaign finance reports, Democrats have made gains on the state high court in recent decades. Do you think that will reverse?
Oh, that's one of the key questions. In some ways, that's almost the most important question before the Ohio electorate this time around. For the first time, control of the Ohio Supreme Court is truly up for grabs this fall. And as we all know, money means so much, especially in these in races like this. For years and years, it's been name ID, or you know, that's been the accusation. Now, for the first time, the justices and chief justice candidates will have party labels with them. That was something the Republicans went through because they thought we got more Republicans in Ohio, so our candidates will do better. Pretty much a political calculation, but we shall see. So, but that's not the only important figure of is what the candidates themselves are reporting. There's going to be such a flood of outside money coming into this race. I mean, already on the Democratic side, Eric Holder's group, National Democratic Redistricting Committee, has pledged big bucks. On the Republican side, the National State, I can't remember the exact title, basically their campaign group for state legislature, state government, has already committed like $21 million nationwide, and they say a big chunk of that's going to go for Ohio. And a lot of this is going to be dark money. Your proportion of goofy, nasty, dirty ads seems to increase proportionally with the groups that you don't really know who they are, and certainly you don't know where their funding is coming from.
You're going to hear, I think, groups who are going to say, you know, gerrymandering really affects what gets on in the legislature. So these statewide races for justice are super important because the gerrymandering doesn't affect them so much. And these are people who, you know, can balance out a legislature if you've got a Republican legislature and you've got a Democratic-led Supreme Court. They can keep them in check. I think we're going to hear more of that argument going into the next few months as well.
Well, with that in mind, Jeremy, you know, what are your expectations for November as it applies to the Supreme Court fighting over redistricting?
In terms of how the election's going to come out, I agree with Joe that, first of all, that the Ohio Supreme Court's been in the headlines far more than it has been in recent years. And I think Daryl's also right that this is a far different Ohio Supreme Court race than we've ever experienced in our lives because, one, as Daryl said, there's going to be party labels for the first time, and no longer are you going to have someone like Democrat Bill O'Neill, who ran for a few thousand dollars, upset Bob Cupp, who's now Speaker, but was a sitting justice who spent more than $1 million on his race. But because there were no party labels, people just decided they liked Bill O'Neill better, you know, and it was kind of the Wild West. And now you're going to see it become much more of a traditional campaign campaign where money plays a much greater role. And now you're going to see that. And frankly, that puts Democrats at a disadvantage because, as you can see now, and say with the governor's race and just about any statewide race, Republicans are raising way more money than Democrats.
Absolutely. Let's switch gears a little bit. So, Daryl, you've been looking into climate change and how to impact Central Ohio, depending on how the world tackles global warming. Temperatures in Columbus could end up being about 6 degrees hotter on average by the end of the century. And what startles me is I used to live in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I heard that Cincinnati could become the new Shreveport, which the humidity there was just incredibly, like something I've never experienced, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, you know, you don't have to move to Louisiana by the end of the century. Louisiana will move to you if you live in Cincinnati, is basically what they're saying here. Uh-huh. Yeah, I went to a journalism seminar, and frankly, it was for other issues I was there, but the first presenter was just fascinating, Bernadette Woods Plackey. She used to be a meteorologist on TV.
Okay.
Emmy
Makes
Award
sense.
Winner mm-hmm. in Louisville was uh-huh. one of her stops. Mm-hmm. She's a Penn State grad. I mean, she's been around the Midwest, so she certainly knows a thing about Midwest weather. Now, and her specialty, she's with a group called the Climate Central, and they have a Climate Matters program. Mm-hmm. They do not take positions as far as advocating for policy, endorsing candidates like that. They're truly nonprofit and all that. And again, don't fall into the trap confusing weather and climate, but she is talking about the impact of climate change on weather. And first of all, she took a look back at what has happened in the Columbus area since 1970. So a little over 50 years ago, the number of summer days that are above the normal temperature has increased by 24 days.
24, yeah.
So 24 days in the last 50 years have been hotter than normal. And, you know, as it gets hotter, the, you know, you do the math, and the normal actually increases with that. And just the, you know, the rains have gotten harder. It's kind of the, it's kind of the thing you talk about your neighbor over the back fence, and especially maybe old timers like me or whatever. Well, I didn't, you know, we used to say, boy, they don't have winters like they used to. Well, now it's no question. There's no question. That's not to say we don't have cold and snow and ice. And oddly enough, climate change is affecting, we're getting greater snow if you live in the snow belt in Ohio, because what makes the snow belt is an open lake, the rising, you know, humidity and everything, and
doesn't
the weather comes across. Right. So when, as long as that's open water, then you're going to get piled of snow in there, Chardon, Ashtabula County, places like that, and of course, way on up into to New York State. So all these things are going on. But yeah, the most fascinating thing was they did a climate migration. So it's like, all right, if these trends continue, which is going to be really bad if they do, they're saying what area now would be what looks like what Ohio is going to look like. So they did, yeah, Cincinnati, and it's going to be Shreveport, Louisiana. And I was talking to her afterwards. I said, well, what did you do like then with Shreveport and like South Texas, all that? They had to go to the Middle East. To look at climate now in the Middle East to say it's going to be like Dubai, what Southern Texas now then is going to be like Dubai is now. It's like, wow. I mean, I just thought, you know, that way, that spoke the story in a way I really hadn't heard it told. And I'll be honest with you, I got all sorts of pushback on this. The other thing she presented was some pretty good opinion polling, very in-depth opinion polling by Yale and I think George Mason and some other groups. Even though certainly we as journalists hear from the climate change deniers a whole lot, you do the polls and there's like 9% that are absolute deniers. Maybe another 10% are, we're not sure about this whole climate change. So, but it's under 20%. Mm-hmm. So fewer than one out of five. It's not to say they don't exist and should not, you know, we still need to listen to them, but we can't pretend they're anywhere close to the majority in this.
So more and more people are starting to kind of believe.
No question. And, you know, you poll things about, at least people say, you know, they support all sorts of things. You know, frankly, some were just featured in the bill that just passed the Senate on, I guess it's early Sunday, wasn't it, on the Inflation Reduction Act about giving incentives to climate change things and, you know, giving us incentives for to buy electric cars, and giving states and local governments incentives to make things more efficiently. That was widely supported in the polling. Now, sometimes polling doesn't translate to public policy, as we all well know in Ohio. But
they're
in this
building
case,
more
it looks
electric
like it
car
is.
Charging stations.
Right. Yes, they're putting more in Ohio. They want to have an electric car charging station available within every 50 miles in Ohio, and that's coming in with some federal dollars. We'll start to see that, and they're going to get these underserved corridors, you know, that are around the state, and make sure they have charging units. We're seeing the car companies in Ohio moving toward either all electric or more hybrid. And the other thing we're seeing, and I guess this is from sort of a personal perspective. When I was a kid growing up, we didn't have air conditioning. Not, few people did, right? And I also had allergies, which back then, it was like I was a weird kid having the allergies, right? Because you never heard anyone else having to take allergy shots.
Not everybody
like,
does.
Yeah. And, you know, it was like as a kid growing up, it was like, wow, you're in a, you know, you have allergies. You're really with me. You're a weirdo like me. Well, now you go to the schools and all the kids have allergies and they're, you know, all taking allergy. I shouldn't say all, but there's a whole lot of them.
A lot of numbers have gone up.
And I it could be that even the majority of kids are, you know, have allergies to something. And I just sit back and wonder sometimes what changed. Is it that we're diagnosing things more, or is it the environment, the climate? You know, what's going on that we're hearing many more kids having problems with asthma and allergies and that sort of thing? There's something going on, and I think we haven't really put – we haven't seen scientists really put the
emphasis
on that. But I think that that's something that needs to be explored because it's affecting public health.
And Bernadette Plackey mentioned that. And again, just a simple fact, summers are longer, growing seasons, pollen season is longer. Yeah. You know, it's going to be worse. And also, we're going to have more mosquitoes. We're going to have more ticks, more Lyme disease. Yeah. Even poison ivy is going to be stronger because I mean, it's like I say, I guess she's been an ex-journalist. She kind of knows how to snag people to get terms. It's like, okay, because normally client science is kind of arcane and, you know, changes by fractions of a degree. Well, that really does have a worldwide effect, but that's hard for people to understand. But wait a minute. The skeeters are going to get even worse. It's going to get even hotter here. I've got the.
Well, I can tell you this: if they get like they were
around for 6 months out of the year, or...
if you talk about mosquitoes like they were in Louisiana, and it's going to be as hot, this might be a whole different place.
We might have white noise from all the bug zappers.
Exactly, exactly. Well, and they were talking about just 6 degrees of warming, right?
In Columbus, and that. Frankly, if that comes, it's, you know, some of these mosquitoes and stuff will probably be the least of our concerns. I mean, it could be catastrophic climate change for the planet, and our kids and grandkids and great-grandkids will suffer the consequences of inaction today.
Okay.
And hopefully there'll be public policy that will come along because, you know, so I've seen people who have their electric shut off in it because they can't pay the bill in the middle of summer. And we've all seen the stories where they've gotten very sick or died from it. And I think public policy, the folks who make public policy are going to have to look at some of these issues and say, hey, something needs to be done here to preserve life and health.
Absolutely. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with our reporters, our weekly reporters at the Roundtable, Jeremy Pelzer, a politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Daryl Rowland, a senior reporter for Columbus Dispatch. We're back in just a couple of minutes to talk about Governor DeWine and what he's saying about the Ohio School Safety Summit. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Natasha Williams in for Ann today. It's our weekly roundtable. Still with us, Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Daryl Rowland, senior reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Daryl, Governor DeWine spoke at the Ohio Safety Summit, School Safety Summit in Columbus last week, saying that a holistic approach to protecting students was needed. What would that entail?
Basically everything but gun control. let's face it. It's we just passed the 3-year anniversary of the mass shootings over in Dayton in the Oregon Entertainment District. And an event that is, you know, at least a minor part in Ohio history. The governor went over there. There was literally either blood in the street or blood had just been cleaned off the street. And he's making a nice little speech and the crowd just cut him off in mass and just start do something. And he pledged that he would. And he did try. Basically, he got, forgive the description, shot down by his fellow Republicans in the legislatures on guns, at least. Now, he has talked about, hardening buildings, making schools safer. He's talked about, you know, improving mental health funding, things of that nature. His opponent, Nan Whaley, called him cowardly.
Oh, she's picking it up and running with it.
She is. Mm-hmm. He said, and I wrote this down because I wanted to get the quote right. It said, he gave up without a fight when the politics got too hard. Mm-hmm. And she points out, well, he's not only not taken action that has gone anywhere to pare down the number of guns, he's gone the other way. He has signed legislation known as Stand Your Ground. You don't have to back down. Greatly reducing the training to carry a concealed weapon. Seems like there's one more. Permitting teachers to be armed in the classrooms and that be
which has been very controversial.
Very much so, and it's interesting. You know, the urban districts basically all said, "Yeah, no way, no how, no where." Some of the rural districts. Obviously, the culture is a little different, and I say, well, maybe
We have a gun, so you know.
I don't know. I was talking to a teacher this weekend at a rural suburban district, and that, you know, he talks among his fellow teachers, and he said, you know, the thing is, if we that's scary to the teachers of all the things that could happen if a child got hold of a gun. Or he said, you know, just think about this. If something were to happen in our school and someone called the police and we're trying to take action and we've got a gun and we're trying to take action against someone, the cops could shoot down the police could shoot down the teacher. Because they've got a gun in their hands. So they're, you know, teachers are thinking about this. This is rolling through their mind all the time, and they're talking about it from different angles. And, you know, some of them might want to carry, but I think there's a whole lot of them who are questioning all the different angles of it.
Well, articles I read said that they have so much going on already.
Right.
And so, you know, you think about the mass shooters and things like that, to get to the gun and be able to protect your students in addition to everything else that's going around, it just seems like a lot to be put on the teacher.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you figure these teachers are having to oftentimes be a counselor. Mm-hmm. They're having to, you know, deal with the health of these students, because the students come in. And I know I have a lot of teacher friends who take it upon themselves to take snacks into their classroom because their kids have a weird lunch hour. It's either too early or too late, and their kids don't, you know, perform at certain times of the day because they're hungry. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking teachers having to do a whole lot more than just teach. And you start throwing, you know, handling security and guns in there, and a lot of teachers are saying, wait, this is where
and gun
we
training
draw.
And all the things that you need basically to take that gun
right.
and use it effectively.
Right.
Well, Nan Whaley has made guns a focus of her campaign, right, Jeremy? Mm-hmm. I mean, it pretty much was easy to do with the unfortunate situation that happened in Dayton and with the stance that Governor DeWine has taken.
Correct, yeah. Nan Whaley, from the beginning of her gubernatorial campaign, has tried to make gun control a big issue because, of course, she was mayor of Dayton when that shooting happened, and she was on stage with the governor when people were yelling, do something, and now, of course, she's trying to make that a big issue. Now, whether it will resonate with people, and that will be people's number one issue, especially now that abortion's on the table, that remains to be seen. But this is an issue that will... It's designed to appeal to the base. You're trying to get a lot of Democratic voters who are angry about what the Republican legislature and DeWine have done, and try to get them to go out and vote. Now, whether that will result in actual votes, the people who are yelling at Mike DeWine, do something, are going to go out and actually do something and go out and vote against Mike DeWine, that remains to be seen. And I don't know about you guys, but I definitely think that Nan Whaley's the underdog going into this election.
Oh, yeah.
Both in terms of, you know, just given how Republican leaning that the state is going, in terms of money, in terms of the power of incumbency, you can give a lot of different reasons.
Mm-hmm. But she's known pretty good throughout the state. I mean, she's not just a person known down south. I mean, she's known throughout the state.
She is known throughout the state. But here's the thing about Governor DeWine has been on the ballot for how many decades now? And people feel like they know him. And a lot of people point out that he is more moderate. And so he has an appeal that Democrats, there are a lot of, you know, independent, you know, maybe Democratic leaning independents who see Governor DeWine as a moderate and would
be folksy.
Yeah, he's folksy, and he knows how to go around, you know, and interact with people. He's very good at being in different situations.
I mean, how many times have you sat and talked with him, and you're talking with him like 10 minutes later? I've had conversations
right.
that go on, and his people pull him away.
Yes, I mean, you know, and a lot of people can relate to him. He's, you know, not. We've had governors in the past who haven't been relatable to the public like he has, but he's someone that people feel they know. And when people feel they know you, you know, a lot of times that definitely works in your favor. Nan Whaley is also very good about, you know, talking to people, but she just doesn't have the longevity of her political career like DeWine does. And I think the one of the huge things is money. I mean, there's going to be so much stinking money this fall. The TV stations, they're going to build palaces on this money.
So, do you think, though, this issue will hurt DeWine?
You know, I don't know. You always look at this and you think, well, you know, there's so many people who say this and that, but people, again, guns are kind of like abortion. I think it's people don't vote on one issue, and so we could see some sort of backlash, but who knows?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it'll hurt with some voters, but the real question is, will it hurt DeWine enough to make a difference in the election? Mm-hmm. And at least in my opinion, Whaley's in a hole to make up. And the big question is if that will fill the hole. And right now I'm skeptical.
Former Mayor Whaley, one of her challenges is to shoot down just what Joe said, that DeWine is perceived as a moderate. And I think she's trying to do that, one, through the gun issue, by saying, well, okay, he tried to do something. He couldn't end up doing anything. So then he starts signing all these very pro-gun legislative bills, despite pledging, don't bring anything to my desk until you pass my plan. Where did that pledge ever go? So she's saying, yeah, he's not so moderate on that. And, okay, let's talk about abortion. He talks about he's the most pro-life governor in the nation. I don't know if that's true or not. He certainly has very solid record with the right to life folks. She is trying to paint that as extreme. She is also trying to contrast their backgrounds. You know, she literally does have the blue collar background, grew up in very humble circumstances. Governor DeWine is a very wealthy man and is very successful and is able, to loan his campaign $3 or $4 million last time around, which has still not been paid back. Campaign, he can certainly dip into the old bank account, do that again to fend off a surge if Whaley's looking strong in late October. I fully agree. Her battle is very much uphill, because I kind of contrast it with, in contrast, Tim Ryan has gotten his name out. Now, he's not running against a well-known incumbent. Huge difference there. Mm-hmm. But he kind of made that controversial decision. He went on the air early with ads, and I think that's made him do well at polls. And spending money sometimes gets you money. We're starting to see now the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, DSCC, in the parlance of we elite political reporters, they're starting to give him a little bit of love in their fundraising push. And I asked him last Friday, are you going to get actual DSCC money in your races? I sure hope so. Because, again, J.D. Vance, both directly and indirectly through Peter Thiel, his big funder in the primary, has probably almost an open checkbook. Although he's doing really poorly so far raising money, that may not matter. But, yeah, so in contrast, I think Ryan has put himself in a credible position, and he has a good amount of money. I think, apples and oranges, sure. But Nan Whaley, I don't think, has quite got to that threshold. And, Labor Day is approaching. Time's getting short. I mean, in fewer than 2 months, people are going to be casting ballots in this race.
And the thing that I keep wondering is what's going to happen with gubernatorial debates this year? Because we have seen the governor and Nan Whaley say they would do these town forums, that kind of debate. But an actual, some actual debates where journalists get to sit there and ask questions. I don't know. We haven't seen any commitments yet. I know Nan Whaley has said she wants to debate. And Governor DeWine's folks have said, well, yeah, he intends to, do something. He's doing these town halls. But I think it's going to be, that could be a big issue, too, because if there's not an opportunity for them to be questioned, voters are going to have to really look back at the records and,
So do you think the debates would definitely favor Whaley to give her, I guess, more exposure?
I don't know. I think it would give, it would give her some exposure, but it also would give a chance for Governor DeWine to talk about some of these issues that he keeps getting, COVID decisions, that sort of thing. It would give him a chance, too. So I'm not sure who it would benefit, but I hope we see him.
Well, we've enjoyed our reporter roundtable with Jeremy Pelzer, a politics reporter, Joe Ingles, reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House Bureau, and Daryl Rowland. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher.